Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. Catherine Ann Lombard is a psychosynthesis psychologist, counselor, writer, and teacher, specializing in activating the will and bringing meaning to the workplace. A published writer of essays, poetry, and news articles, she teaches academic writing at the University of Twente in the Netherlands. Her latest book is From Culture Shock to Personal Transformation, Studying Abroad and the Search for Meaning. Having lived in 11 countries on 4 continents, this book is a fascinating look into being a foreigner in a foreign land and the psychosynthesis journey towards inner wholeness. Catherine, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Kara. It's really a privilege to be here, and I'd like to thank all your listeners joining us today.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be a very full and intriguing conversation. Now, the word journey means many things to you, I imagine. It's sort of a signpost of your life in different ways. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you on your journey in this life?
Yeah, I think most outer journeys are a reflection of the inner personal journey that we all make, and I think the two are deeply interwoven, that you can't really tell one without the other, tell one story without the other. And my journey in the outer world to 11 different countries in my adult life was probably from the outside, if looking in, was due to my own curiosity of different people and different places, but also different opportunities that came into my life. In my early 20s, I had a chance to go to Spain and live there for 14 months, and then later, graduating the university, I went and got a job teaching English in Japan and was there for 2 years. And then while I was in my 30s, I was sent by my company in Silicon Valley to Luxembourg to work. And then for different reasons, I decided to stay in Europe. Mm-hmm. Then from Luxembourg, I found work in Ireland. And that's where I met my husband. And then it was through my husband that, and his connections, that we were able to go and live in Egypt for a year. And then through my own connections, we were able to move to Italy. So the journey was a willingness to go and explore the world, but also lots of opportunities to do so. And that would be the matter-of-fact kind of outer story. But then that always goes, like I said, with an inner story. And part of my journey, my outer journey, is also because I've always been a seeker of truth and meaning in my life. And one story I can tell you, like when I was 6 or 7, I grew up, I was born in 1955, so I was right, 6 or 7 was right during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
And I remember being marched, doing the drills for the nuclear, if nuclear war came onto the U.S.
And duck and cover.
Sorry?
Duck and cover.
Yeah,
the
duck and cover
in
and
school.
Hide. Yeah. I mean, ridiculous things like hide under your desk and
right.
hide in the closet. And, I mean, these are really vivid memories for me. And then one in particular was we were all marched into the gymnasium at the school, and so there were like 200 kids in this gymnasium, and the principal came out and said, told us, this is where you're going to stay if the bad Russians come and drop a bomb, and you won't be able to go outside.
Oh my gosh.
And you won't be able to go home, and your parents won't be able to come and get you, and we'll all be here in the gymnasium. So I was like, must have been 6 years old, and I went afterwards to my teacher, and I said, why are you adults doing this? because this isn't any fun and this doesn't make any sense to me.
And it's very scary.
So even at that age, I was questioning why, and I had a sense of this evil that was could possibly happen, and not understanding, not trying to make sense of it. And so it's just a tendency I have of who I am, part of who I am, I guess. And then that search, that inner search for meaning and understanding what life is about really crystallized when I was 15. My family was hit by a huge tragedy. My father was murdered. And that event, which happened in such a time in my life when I was just trying to discover who I was and what I was meant to do, really propelled me into a real search for meaning and trying to figure out what is this life about, what is the meaning in death, and how do we make meaning of suffering, and who am I, and where am I in all this mess?
And it's interesting, I appreciate that you use the word propelled, because someone else might have said derailed.
Oh, right.
But you were propelled, which, you know, that the forward movement in your life continued with your seeking, and that, of course, a terrible but defining moment somehow. Now, I just want to, you were talking about making meaning out of suffering,
right,
which, of course,
well,
is so key to so many of us in life.
Psychosynthesis.
Right.
Not getting derailed, but actually being propelled.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And let me ask you just briefly, did you have any tools, or were you equipped somehow already, either through a religious background or spiritual awareness, for such soul searching? Or, I mean, were you raised in a religious background, or have some kind of exposure to that at that time?
Yeah, I think a lot of it. I think that's what the beauty of your show is. You know, so many of us are left on our own trying to figure this out. And as a child, I was raised Catholic and was sent to catechism class, and my mother gathered us. We were four kids, and she gathered us up on Sundays to go to Mass. But my father, for some reason unknown to us, would always stay home, and we would say, well, Daddy, aren't you coming to church with us? And he would always say, no, I have to mind the house. And it didn't make sense to me, but okay. And then when he died, I was told that he had been married before and had been excommunicated for marrying my mother. And so, technically he was supposed to be in hell, which made no sense to me, and because he was a very kind and gentle man. Mm. And so I was really left with my faith, my Catholic faith, at that point, and I kind of doubled down. You know, I really went into prayer myself, and I found the adults around me absolutely had no way of coping with this. It was 1970, so there were no, there was not group therapy, didn't exist. There were no victim rights, or, you know, no one went to a psychologist or psychotherapist unless you were completely mad or a movie star.
Oh my!
You know, and.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, I think I've been alone a lot of my life trying to figure things out.
And it's fascinating, Catherine, to me, because, you know, at that moment, I mean, this is essentially what, you know, the faith or religion or church is for, to make meaning out of suffering, to go through different forms of death and resurrection to help you in your new life going forward.
Right.
And it's amazing how many get, just toss the whole thing because of these what could be considered non-essential matters of faith, so that the larger spiritual journey, let's say, of what of the core of the Catholic faith was just, you know, missing in your experience of it.
I think the problem is most people, you know, it's very easy to talk in theological terms, but to really experience and live it yourself is a whole other ball game. And I think many people are frightened of life and death and redemption and resurrection and what it really means when it comes to living the Christian life.
That's yes, in which we go through sufferings, you know, continually. It's not just an end-of-life thing.
No, absolutely not.
But, you know, but how we respond to and transform as these events happen. So there you are at that moment feeling, you know, alone and unsupported, but still such a great, questioner.
Yeah.
and seeker, you know.
Oh, I was desperately confused and lost. And, yeah, I mean, my 20s was just really a very lost decade in my life because I didn't know how to deal with all the feelings that were coming up. Mm. And so I didn't, you know, and turned to drugs and alcohol. And, yeah, I was really lost because I had no one there really to help me and no way out, like no way to really find my way out.
So you have the questions. What is this life all about? What is the meaning in life and death? How do we make meaning of suffering? So then, you know, where did you go from there? How did you ultimately find the path that you've been living?
Well, that, you know, we need about... that's a long story. But I guess ultimately, I did yoga and I did meditation and I turned to all kinds of, when I was in Japan, of course, I was exposed to Eastern philosophy and I experienced all kinds of, I really searched, I turned to Tibetan prayer wheels and I went to India and I really desperately searched and nothing really clicked because I think I wasn't really in touch with my feelings. I needed to go through the whole grieving and the whole process of the pain and the betrayal and I needed to go through all the feelings and I was kind of running around avoiding all the feelings.
Mm. But it does seem you were reaching out somehow knowing the answer was somehow spiritual, but something, you know, critical was not part of the journey yet.
Yeah, I've always was spiritually connected to something. I mean, I'm deeply intuitive, and I have a tremendous dream life. So I knew there was more than just the rational world for the answers. I knew I had to search in the spiritual dimension for the answers. And then it was around my 40s when I read Joseph Campbell, and he has I think it's the Way to Bliss or something like that, his book. And he says, you know, the surest way is to hook up with your ancestors. Hmm. We all have to take a path, and we need to take one path to go deeply. And, you know, it's not easy if you dabble here and dabble there. You really have to make a choice, I think, and choose a path and really go for that. And he says, if you go with where your ancestors have been, you may have an easier try. I remember reading that, and then I just had this image of my grandparents, who are most Italian ancestry, some Scottish, and they're all up in heaven, you know, scratching their heads. There goes Catherine. Where is she off to now? You know, why doesn't she come back? Mm. We could help her, you know. And I was really touched by grace and returned to my Christian roots. I think for me, the Christian way is really about relationship, and that really ties in with psychosynthesis as well. It's I think to find your way out, to discover meaning in the suffering and to understand your life, you can't do this alone. It's always in relationship.
Thank
you. The Christian faith really, helps define that.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. You know, as an author on the saints, I tend to find that the mystics tend to hold a lot of the wisdom around this, seeming to rise above the, those little details that can catch the institutional church, and that you felt as a teenager. You know, there's a saying, God,
right.
God is in the details, but I've learned,
absolutely.
You know, so is the devil.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So getting beyond the... you know, the sort of workaday details that can trap us, I find that there's a lot of wisdom there that's relationship-centered. So now, you eventually became a psychosynthesis psychologist.
Yeah,
and,
imagine.
This sounds fascinating to me because, I'm saying it properly?
Yes, you are.
Good. Because, as I read a little into it, it includes the higher self. As
right.
part of the psychological journey. So can you share, and we'll get more into relationships in a little bit, but can you share sort of the basis of what is psychosynthesis?
Right. Psychosynthesis is basically the process through which we become fully human beings and experience our wholeness as a human person. And psycho, of course, comes from the Greek word psyche, which means soul. And synthesis is also from a Greek word, which means to put together. So you're really rebuilding your personality, rebuilding your soul into who you really are meant to be through the process. And you start with yourself. You start with coming into relationship with yourself and your own body, your relationship to your body, your relationship to your feelings, and to your thoughts, and to your personal history.
Mm.
So
now,
you start there.
May I just ask, is this fully human wholeness, I'm just asking, is it something that we might be born with but lose? And need to regain? What do you think about that?
Yeah, there's different theories. But, I mean, you know, there's different theories. But my experience is what I believe is like we are born with this connection to the higher self. And we are born in our full human humanity, in our full wholeness. You know, we need to learn how to express that. I mean, we're infants. We can't talk. We can't make music. We can't, you know, do much art. But we need to, you know, develop into a consciousness in order to express our full being. But it, typically that connection gets wounded. And it's in infancy, that and it's through relationships. So... typically, it's wounded, and unconsciously or consciously wounded by the primary, what I call the primary caregiver.
Mm.
It's inevitable because no caregiver is perfect.
Right.
And so we're all going to we're all walking wounded in a sense, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is good.
Huh. I like that. Okay. So we are somehow wounded or perhaps got a little fragmented along the way and learn to live in our way, but not necessarily the having that wholeness.
Right. But imagine if we were born and stayed whole, then what would we do? You know, I mean...
Right.
We part of the adventure of life is to come into an understanding of our full human wholeness. Mm. You know, I mean that's the exciting part too.
Yeah,
and it's painful, but it's also there's a lot of joy in that too.
Mm. Oh yeah,
you know?
Yes. Well, as you said, if you can make the meaning of the suffering. I found, like, for example, my family coming from, you know, war-torn countries to America, you know, different grandparents had different, you know, outcomes of
sure.
this, and some were able to make that meaning and find joy for the new generation here you know, go to their, you know, graves with the American flag on their lapel and
right.
all of that. And then there were others who, rather than, you know, take the suffering and make it a string of pearls, made it like a litany of sorrows.
And, yeah,
and,
well, it's
and
not
we're not
easy.
Really able to make that journey of finding
sure.
the meaning
easy.
In it.
Sure, it's
right.
not an easy. This is, we're talking really tough going here.
Right.
This is not the, yeah, this is not ice cream
right.
spirituality.
And as you said, so many of these, you know, forms of treatment or therapies really were not around. And,
right.
you know, something like PTSD or you know, post-war
right.
syndromes are really recent.
Yes.
You know, diagnoses and generally only for those who have been in, you know, armed duty, but there's also so many civilians, which
right.
we have not even,
right.
be, you know, really begun to point toward yet. So
mm-hmm.
Let's return to psychosynthesis then. You come into relationship with your own body, as you said.
Right.
And you're relating to your body and your feelings
mm-hmm.
and what's running through your head. Now, something key here seems to be revolving around the will. So then you discuss activating the will. And can you share the role of the will in psychosynthesis?
Well, the will needs to be activated just to, you know, take the first step on the journey, you know?
Yeah.
I always say if I have someone contact me to make our first appointment, that I know the will is already activated because they're already engaged with, okay, they're willing to take the first step on this journey. And you need the will to push you through sometimes. You also, Acergioli, who is the founder, Roberto Acergioli, who is the founder of psychosynthesis, has written a book, The Act of Will, which if anyone is interested in psychosynthesis, I'd say start with this book. And he has four aspects of the will, because most of us think of the will as, you know, this Victorian kind of idea of strong will and pushing through everything. But there's more to the will than just the strong will. There's also skillful will. He talks about a car. So the strong will would be the person that gets behind the car and tries to push it up the hill. That you get the car up the hill with strong will. But skillful will is the person that gets in the car, you know, arranges the mirrors, knows where to put in the key, the ignition key, and starts the car and gets it up the hill. So there's different aspects of the will. Then there's the goodwill. And the goodwill is where we make a choice, where we choose to do something that is for the higher good of either yourself or the other or the environment or whatever. So it's a choice. It's an act of will that is good. And then the fourth will is the transpersonal will, which would be connected to the higher self.
I see.
So it's about, you know, we all have, like, I have a very strong will. And for me, it was learning how to develop my skillful will. And I have a pretty good goodwill, you know. But we're all a little bit out of balance. Like, one will be stronger than the other. And it's about learning to balance and learning to use them in the most effective way in our lives. Does that answer your question?
That's fascinating, yes, because I can see how, you know, growing up out of the, you know, whatever childhoods we came into, that we would learn to lean on one, you know, aspect of will more than another just in order to live and enjoy life, you know, as much as possible given the circumstances, but
right.
how we could also get out of balance.
And
yeah, I can relate
well,
to that.
Well, it depends on the family environment. It also depends
right.
on your tendency, you know, who you are as a person. You know, you may be more skillful or at managing relationship
right.
With words, and or you might be so strong-willed that you just push through. So, yeah, it's kind of what's allowed in your environment and then also what you have inside you, what your tendency is just naturally.
So we're learning to cultivate and have these different aspects work together better in a more helpful way.
Yeah, and to come into relationship with your will.
And now, yeah, this is very, very insightful and intriguing. Now, you say psychosynthesis is one of the few psychologies today that includes a higher self as part of the model of the human psyche.
Right.
Can you share about the higher self here?
Yeah, the higher self is it's both paradoxically individual and universal. So it's dual in nature. And Astrojoli has a model of the human psyche where it's actually included as part of the human psyche. And it doesn't matter, it's not tied to any doctrine or any dogma. It's a very open system. But what it's pure consciousness and will, the higher self. And the center of our own authentic being is connected, okay, to this higher self, which is what we call the I-self connection, which is typically wounded, like I said before, in childhood. So what it is all about, really, what the journey is all about, is reconnecting to the self, the higher self. And the higher self... So the I, the center of pure consciousness and will that is within us, is a reflection, a pale reflection of the huge potential of this higher self. And what's so beautiful about psychosynthesis psychology is that it's so adaptable to any spiritual search or anyone who is looking for a way to integrate their spiritual life into their human, in the context of who they are as a human being psychologically. And I have lots of atheists come to me. It's amazing. Mm. And yet it doesn't matter because I'm holding this model as we do our work together. And I'm holding the space for the self to come in and work, because the self is always pulling us towards our higher potential, our higher, human wholeness, human, all these qualities like courage and mercy and forgiveness and sacrifice come out of the higher self, because there's no rational reason why we should be brave. Or sacrifice. There's no rational reason. That can't come out of our heads. That comes out of somewhere else.
Right.
And yet, it's universal. You know, nobody has nobody can just claim these qualities. These are universal human qualities.
Right. We find them in all cultures and as we have learned, in all faiths around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that common ground of the heart or compassion or the higher self, as you say, really does drive us. And it's not speculative to me anymore. I think it's just sort of more of a fact.
That is
part of our human nature.
Exactly. And Astrojoli talks about it like you don't need to prove. He developed his vision out of his own experience, and he was a student of Freud. He was born in 1888 in Venice, and he was the first psychoanalyst in Italy, and he was a contemporary of Jung, and he believed that there's no need to prove the higher self. It's purely an experience, and it's been written about in every culture and religious practice throughout history. This is what you're talking about, the mystics and the relationship they have with God and each other. And it's like saying you have to prove the color blue, is what he writes. And you don't have to, even if someone doesn't see blue, you know, maybe they're not open to blue, or maybe they can't see blue, or maybe they haven't had a chance to see blue yet. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right. Or if they've seen many shades of blue but call it by something else.
Yeah.
Well, this
it's
is
still
this is
there,
the,
you yeah. know, and that's what's so wonderful about psychosynthesis, because you're being held by this this higher consciousness and will in your own search.
Well, thank you very much for that. We're about halfway through the program, Catherine, and when we return from the break, I want to discuss this, get more into this.
Great.
Okay. With you, but we're just going to take a short break. Stay on the line.
Okay.
You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from our break, we'll continue our conversation with Catherine Ann Lombard, and we'll also discuss her new book. So make sure you stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Catherine Ann Lombard, psychosynthesis psychologist and author. Now, Catherine, in the first half of the program, we were discussing psychosynthesis and how it is one of the only forms of psychology that incorporates the higher self as part of the psyche and as part, a component of the will. As well. In this part of the program, I'd like to get a little bit more into how your work takes place in the workplace and the kind of methods that, that you utilize to help people in this regard, because making meaning of suffering was part of the first half of this discussion today, but also making meaning sometimes when we have difficulty in our daily work is another big critical point people deal with.
Right. I the workplace, well, I think, you know, life is work, and most of our adult life is spent doing some kind of work, whether you're in an office building or you're a homemaker or mother or father or whatever work that happens to be. It's inevitable that your adult life will be spent working. And, of course, that means that you will be in relationship, but not just with the people at your office or in your family, but also with your with the work yourself, with the work itself. And it's important that you also, at the workplace, you know, you're making choices. Every minute of every day, there's a choice being made of some kind or another. And it's important that you understand how you're making choices. And, you know, a choice is an act of will. A choice is you are executing the will with every choice that you make. And if you don't know what you're doing or why you're doing it or what you want, then you're not really free in the choices that you're making. So
yeah.
It's about, again, coming back to yourself and to your story and to your feelings and to your thoughts and to your body sensations and understanding what exactly is going on. Because I have a lot of clients, they come in and the presenting issue is, my supervisor said this and this and I don't know how to cope with him or her, or they have a problem coming forward and really standing up for themselves in some way or presenting themselves in some way. And these look like workplace issues, but when we really explore the story of the person, they're really coming out of a deeper place.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do, is go to that deeper place.
And I'm sure, I mean, not very many folks are encouraged to be, you know, reflective in the workplace, and as well as to consider something like the higher self in the workplace and how these interact as colleagues.
Right.
Right.
Or even to think, you know, we're in relationship. I mean, that can be revolutionary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a relationship here, whether we want it or not, you know, and how to be in what psychosynthesis calls right relations. How can you be your authentic self in the group and or within, you know, the work group? Which is really tough. It's a tough thing to learn how to do, but it's something we have to learn, I think. It's not something we just, you know, you're good at, or you may have a gift for it or a talent for it, but it doesn't come easy for everyone, I don't think.
Right. And even if we learn it, it also has to somehow become a practice.
Yes.
You know, as we encounter those similar situations again, and there are, you know, folks with qualities who are able to deflect a lot of this.
Right.
But,
yes.
But
my husband's very good at that, actually.
Right. But, you know,
into a crowd and everything goes off of him, and, you know, he can maneuver through and everything's fine. And I'm just like on eggs, kind of going, oh my God, you know. And yeah, it's also, again, your own personality, what your tendency is, but also what you learned as a child, how you learned to be in relationship in your family, what was allowed and what wasn't. You know,
right.
Some people, anger was never allowed. And
right.
So how do you express anger when you start to feel it? Because it needs to be expressed. Because as soon as you start repressing those feelings, they have to go somewhere. Feelings never go away until they're felt. That's the only way to get rid of your feelings is to feel them.
And unfortunately,
and a lot of people
are
afraid of their own feelings.
And they can come out sideways in the
workplace. Oh, upside down, inside out, sideways. Yeah.
Well, and that's very important, you know, finding meaning at work, especially, you know, in these times also of our economic challenges and polarizations, you know, to find meaning in our personal life as well as
in
our work life.
This isn't easy. These times are not easy. And I'm not talking, you know, I really want to emphasize that this journey is not, I can vouch that this journey is not an easy journey. And yet, it's the only way, I think, that you can really go through things. And I think when you really, again, make the choice, okay, I'm really going to be honest in my life. I'm really going to be sincere in what I'm doing and what I'm feeling and how I'm thinking about things. I mean, that's also really key, that you are really honest with what's going on. And then to see, what choices am I making? And are those the choices that I really want to make? Mm. And sometimes we choose because it's what we've done all our lives. It's the strategy we've kind of survived on. And usually we come into a crisis of meaning like at the workplace, or we might be doing something that we really don't find satisfying. And that's really a call from the higher self for some reflection and some perhaps a step towards what you really, really want.
Now, when we talk about meaning, which can, you know, call to mind different definitions perhaps for different people.
Right.
To you, what would be at the center of meaning?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
And I know you had made some reference to Viktor Frankl previously.
Well, I think I always turn to Viktor Frankl because I just think he has such a huge experience and such a breadth of understanding of the meaning. And, of course, his book, Man's Search for Meaning, is brilliant. And for those that maybe aren't familiar with him, he was a survivor of four different concentration camps and was a psychoanalyst at the time. And so he did his field work, basically, and wrote an absolutely stunning book, what I find really stunning anyway. And he says meaning is found in three different aspects of our lives. And the first is through active, you know, what we do actively, so in the workplace, in the home, what we create, our life is a creation as well, you know, how you... you don't have to be a grand artist. You know, you're creating every day of every minute. You know, your life is your palette and your canvas. And so how you are active in your life is one way to find meaning.
Mm.
And then he says the second way is that passively. So your experience of art, of beauty, of nature, of laughter of your children, whatever you passively enjoy also gives meaning to your life. And the third way, he says, is through the suffering that we experience. And this is where what you're talking about, the redemption of that suffering and coming into some understanding of that suffering will also give meaning to your life. And I think when we only look for meaning through active or passive creation part of our lives, that we miss a whole huge realm of a place for meaning. And I can also speak about this personally, of course, through the tragedy of my father's murder. It was a huge journey to redeem what happened to me and my family, and yet coming through that, I think, brought a huge understanding of the human condition and human suffering, and only through that could I have any kind of compassion when someone is sitting in front of me in the client room. Mm. You know, otherwise, how could I possibly meet anyone in their own suffering?
Yeah, and not remain only clinical.
Nothing is going to get fixed clinically.
Well, you say about compassion in an article, a beautiful article you wrote.
Thank you.
It's remind me of the title of it with the tea.
Love and Will in a
Teacup. Yes. Mm. And you say in there, we think of love mostly as an innate, spontaneous experience. Yet compassion towards all creation can also be developed through a willful choice.
Right.
And I find that, I've enjoyed that very much, that we only have our experience and intuition and a full and sincere heart.
Right.
Could you share a little bit more about compassion as a willful choice?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, when Astor Joly actually talks about this, when there's love with no will, it becomes just out. It's not activated. It's not alive. It's not shared. It's not in relationship to anything. And So if it's, and if there's will without love, then it becomes it can be very harsh and very cold. So you really need love and will together. And it's through the synthesis of love and will that I think compassion and empathy can be practiced and brought to a higher reality. Yeah, love and will, it's so central to psychosynthesis and to any work that I do with my clients, because I'm trying to hold the love, you know, the love, the great love of the higher self. I mean, and also to see where is the will stuck? What needs to be healed? What suffering hasn't been felt and needs to be gone through? And can I witness that? Because, you know, it's in relationship that you heal, and it's through the sharing of story that you heal. And I think when we try to do this by ourselves, it's like trying to move a wheel without any oil on it. You know, it's just, you need to be be together in this and share the suffering, and then through that storytelling and through that love that is held between you, and through the will of telling the story, sharing the story, going to the feelings, going through the grief. That's the compassion, and that's the redemption, and that's the joy at the end of it.
Well, I really enjoy your use of the word witness there, because I think that that's really important, that when we go through things that there is someone who is a witness that says, I see you have gone through this.
Absolutely.
You know, that not just observing it, but also the validation in that, and the safety in that, and it's very, very supportive. Now, as we're heading towards the last part of the program, I don't want to forget to explore some of your latest book as well, Culture Shock, to Personal Transformation, Studying Abroad and the Search for Meaning. I love this because I can relate to it in part as a student who did travel also. In my studies, and the feeling of being that, you know, stranger in a strange land.
Right.
Can you share some about this study and, you know, the going from culture shock to, like, immersion and what we gain from this?
Well, I did a lot of work with PhD students at the University of Twente, international PhD students who were that came from all over the world. I had clients from China, Austria, Portugal, Italy, Brazil, and you end up on it's kind of like the Odyssey. You know, you go in a boat and you kind of know where you're going, and I mean with the internet and everything, but you end up in a completely different place, and you're really up against yourself, basically. You're really up against yourself, because all the strategies and all the ways you had of maneuvering through your own culture and your old life don't necessarily work anymore. Mm-hmm. And so there can be a crisis, an existential crisis of really, who am I now? I mean, what belongs to me and what doesn't belong to me, and who am I going to come out of, you know, the phoenix coming out of the ashes here? And so I saw huge personal transformation happening as we worked in a psychosynthetic way through their stories and through the issues that they were bringing in. Some of them were definitely connected to being, you know, dealing with supervisors that weren't in their own, from their own culture.
Right.
Yeah, or coping with relationships that they formed that weren't, they maybe only formed because they were so alone here, you know, without family or friends, that suddenly a relationship forms that is filling a void. But also it's amazing because sometimes this is also a can be a call of the higher self, that you suddenly find yourself in a foreign country, and it's exactly this, you know, the higher self wanting you to really find out who you are, you know, and not rely on all the old patterns and the old ways of being. And so that's an identity crisis, and to come through that, you need to be in relationship. You need help, I think, to really come through it and become more authentic. You need to be in relationship. You need someone to reflect and with you and see what's going on. And so the book is about psychosynthesis and how I used it with my clients, these young PhD students, and lots of testimonies of theirs in it. And just, I think what fascinated me, you know, God has a huge sense of humor because, you know, there I was kind of hidden away on campus and in the Christian, you know, the pastor meeting room, and one atheist after the next would come in. And yet all of them touched, you know, in the end were in touch with a deeper spiritual self than they ever had before. And it didn't matter. The self is there. The self is there whether you, whether you want to, you know, whether you believe in God, or Allah or Buddha or whatever. There's huge help out there in the universe to pull you along if you're open to it.
And being out there on your own as a student without your familiar places and people, and, you know, just calls upon you to not only to adapt but also to reach in to find out what you have to offer.
Amazing as we did the work together, and they were processing a lot of childhood trauma or different things that they needed to let go of, that released so much energy that they could then use in their creative and scientific lives. And they would start winning awards, and they would start being, you know, the best presentation, and they all finished their PhDs. And so this work releases, it's hard work, it's hard going, but in the end, you so much energy is freed up.
Right.
For creative activity.
Right. I remember I took the third year of my college studies in England, and I couldn't get back to the U.S. for the holidays, and so I wound up making the Thanksgiving meal for my you know, roommates over there in London, and they really had no familiarity with the Thanksgiving meal, and we wound up, you know, sharing that together in a very different place.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's interesting when we even think about the Christian missionaries whose original idea of mission was to go to someplace else and change them into basically Europeans without actually getting to know them at all, and how that changed over time. The term enculturation developed, and for example, like the Jesuits did that when they went to China. They wore the Chinese clothes, they learned the language,
right.
And they lived there.
Right.
And they wound up, you know, learning about each other and influencing each other. And that's, you know, where that growth came from, and interfaith dialogue that started centuries ago. You know, the attitude that it, you know, changed quite a bit from culture shock to that personal transformation that you share about. So then when the students then are transformed and they return to their, you know, regular place of living or working, what do they bring then? And, you know, what's the significant learning?
Yeah, they all say they have more peace.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to relate better to their parents. They have a better understanding of who they are. They one told me he'll make a better husband and father. So it's all about changing the inside, and then through changing the inside, the outer world becomes a different place as well. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, tied into what you were talking about with the idea of the Jesuits going, and, you know, this is also pilgrimage. This is why people go on pilgrimage.
Yeah.
You go to another place, an outer place, a place of you know, it's maybe up a mountain or to a special Chartres or,
yeah.
It's an outer journey, but what you're really trying to do is an inner journey.
Mm-hmm.
And this pilgrimage is to change you inside, you know. And that can happen also when you go abroad, mm-hmm. and you live in another world, as well. The outer journey can be used to change your inner life.
Well, Catherine, that's so beautifully said. And as we come to the end of the program, I want to let listeners know that all of your website and contact and book information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I wanted to thank you for being on the program today. Your work, to me, takes that journey for us and turns it into that pilgrimage of meaning. So I want to thank you so much for our conversation and for all your good work.
Thank you. It's been great fun.
Same here. Stay in touch.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And remember to join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here at prn.fm at 2 p.m. Eastern Time every Sunday. Until we meet again, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.